Well, tonight, what a story. The topic of our show tonight is Christian manhood, or why are Christians such wimps, or should Christians get involved in politics in order to defend their values? And we have a great guest tonight, and we were going to have Tristan Emmanuel of noapologies.ca, but he wasn't available. And we got a man who is a real Christian, who's always ready to come on and speak the truth as he sees it. And that's Reverend Ted Pike, who I literally phoned just 20 minutes ago. And that's to me, a real evangelist who's willing to come on and talk with just 20 minutes notice. Ted, are you there?
Yes, I am, Henry. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on. I've been following your writing for some time, and I'm so impressed. I was just preparing for the show tonight, and I got a hard copy of your latest article, "Bible is Hate," says U.S. Government. But before we go into the details of this article, which basically seems to want to outlaw Christianity, let me ask you a little bit about yourself, Ted. Can you give us a little background, a little introduction to you?
Well, my parents were pioneers in the Christian conservative movement going literally back to 1949. My father was a Methodist minister, and my mother and father became very, very concerned, especially with the collapse of China under the revolutionary overthrow by Mao Zedong, and very concerned about the rise of communism. And my parents gradually left the ministry to attempt to wake up the nation, both the church and the nation, to the threat of liberalism, both theological and political liberalism. And father was a veteran radio broadcaster, especially here in the Pacific Northwest. He had a Christian conservative radio program for many years, and I was pretty much nurtured on the knee of my father and mother as they introduced me to the whole gamut of Christian conservatives.
Ted, you make your parents proud and Christians proud. We'll be back in 3 minutes and to get into this very, very serious topic. Welcome back, everyone. Our guest tonight is Reverend Ted Pike, and our topic is, why are Christians such wimps? And I'm referring to, why don't Christians defend their values and defend their religion and their view of society in the public square? And when I think of one Christian who is actually manning the barricades, I think of Reverend Ted Pike, who for some time has been fighting anti-hate laws and rallying the people to write to Congress, and has actually had a certain amount of success. Ted, can you tell us more about some of the battles you fought and won?
Well, continuing my chronology of my life, in 1984, I came out with my book, Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma. I had been very concerned for many years that the evangelical church should be hearing the whole truth about this Zionist conspiracy, and the people who had been attempting to portray those truths to the evangelical church were rather strident and harsh and often undocumented and so on. And I attempted to create a bridge between that those anti-Zionist voices and researchers over to the evangelicals, showing how that the present rise of international Zionism and Jewish world control and so on is actually just a fulfillment of Bible prophecies concerning how Babylon the Great or the great harlot Israel will rise to ascendancy and world government over the nations. And then in 19, 87, I created a 60-minute documentary called The Other Israel, which is now, anyone can watch that on Google. Just go to www.video.google.com and you can watch The Other Israel plus three other major video documentaries I've done free of charge. But these two works, my book in 84 and my video in 87, were very, very much trailblazing works. I went out and I really spit out the whole truth about the Zionist Talmudic conspiracy and encouraged a number of other people, for example, people like Tex Mars and recently Mark Glenn. They say that I played a pivotal role in enlightening them and giving them courage to go out and speak the truth also. Specifically, I've specialized in educating and warning Christian conservatives against the threat of so-called anti-hate laws. And beginning in about 1989, I began to specialize in that. And unfortunately, the church was not interested in that issue. And the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, was able successfully to pass anti-hate laws in some 45 states of the Union, primarily from about 1990 to 2000. But the big federal hate crimes law bill has been before the House and the Senate about six or seven times since 1998, and our National Prayer Network has been in the vanguard of educating and warning, and especially in the last 4 years I've been on the radio. I've been interviewed about over 500 times, 500 interviews in the last 3 years on alternative talk radio primarily, but some mainstream radio, pretty much leading the charge often against imminent passage of the federal hate crimes bill. And we were spectacularly successful, especially in this last year, in defeating not only the hate crimes bill in the first half of the 110th Congress, but also a number of other Orwellian bills. About four or five of them also have gone down to defeat or a permanent postponement till the next Congress, largely because of the activism which the National Prayer Network was able to stimulate, especially last January and February, and galvanizing a lot of activism out of Republican senators in the, Republican House members in the House of Representatives. And this snowballed into a very large movement as new right organizations like Dobson's Organization and Family Research Council and others joined the fray in fighting against the hate bill.
How would you characterize the reaction of the Christian church in general? I mean, I'm not talking about the Catholics, but the Christian church in general to this threat. Would you say it's complacent, or would you say the Christians are willing to react and act if they're petitioned?
Well, it's been very heartening in the last several years. Up until several years ago, the church really did have its head in the sand. And I think one of the reasons for that is that it was fairly well known, and I certainly made it well known, that the Anti-Defamation League, which is a Jewish civil liberties organization, was the primary architect of hate crimes legislation, not only in America, Canada, Australia, but also in Europe. And evangelicals have not wanted to get into the space of the Jewish activists because of their propensity for calling all of their enemies and opponents anti-Semites. They didn't want to open that can of worms. But actually, they've been forced to do that to a very large degree in the last several years. They're not identifying these Jewish activists as the source of hate laws, but they are phoning and writing and militating against hate crimes laws. I think the watershed moment was back in 2004, October 2004, when Lynn Abraham, who is the executive board member of the ADL and also the district attorney of Philadelphia, gave orders to have 11 Christians rounded up, arrested, and locked for 21 hours in the Justice Center jail, and she socked them with seven different arrest warrants, which would have led to 47 years in prison for each one of those people. And they had done nothing but literally hold up signs with Bible verses and sing a song a praise to the Lord there within a big homosexual rally. And I was able during that fall to get on many stations, both in the far right or the alternative talk radio and on Christian radio, and really let the church and the world know of this outrage in Philadelphia, and that begin to open their eyes to the imminent threat of state hate crimes laws, because this was under the authority of the Pennsylvania, the ADL Pennsylvania hate crimes laws. And so I coined the term the Philly 11, and it very rapidly spread all across the country as the evangelicals began to be concerned. And that was really the beginning of real concern about hate crimes legislation. And fortunately, people like Focus on the Family, Family Research Council, Traditional Family Values Coalition, and others in the religious right have had their eyes opened about hate crimes laws. They have joined me rather sporadically, but they have joined me in fighting against especially the federal hate crimes law, which we have been able to defeat once again this year.
Now, what's the name of your organization again? The Prayer Network, was it?
Yeah, our organization is the National Prayer Network, but we have a website, which is www.truthtellers.org. And at truthtellers.org, we have, without a doubt, the largest body of documentation and creative thinking and writing on the problem of hate crimes legislation worldwide.
So if listeners want to step up and actually defend their values, that's the website to go to, www.
Absolutely. It's usually number one on, it certainly is number one on all of the search engines under hate crimes laws or hate crimes education. There's really nobody who's done the real background work on it like we have. In fact, we do have a video, an 80-minute video, which is also available on Google at www.video.google.com. It's called Hate Laws Making Criminals of Christians. We went to the ADL headquarters in Seattle and filmed in front of the big tower there. And also we went up to Canada, to Vancouver, and did a lot of filming documenting how that the northern branches of ADL, which is the neighbor of Canada and the Canadian Jewish Congress, brought into being Canada's hate crimes law, the Canadian Human Rights Act, which was passed in Ottawa in 1971 and has battled with Canada with great restrictions under Section 319, which makes it a criminal offense to incite hatred or contempt of a federally protected group such as Jews or homosexuals.
Right, but it's quite subjective as to what qualifies as inciting hate. I mean, essentially any criticism is something that they will say is inciting hate when in fact a criticism is the breath of life.
Absolutely.
You mentioned Christian organizations who are on board. What about all the Christians that are not on board? Who is ignoring this imminent danger?
Well, I think the liberal branches of Christendom aren't paying too much attention to it, and also the Catholic branches aren't. But I do believe, thanks to the alerts and the support by primarily Dr. Dobson and the Family Research Council, which are two of the very largest, it is spreading very widely. A concern. Also, WorldNet Daily shows us Farah's WorldNet Daily. He's a Christian, I understand, and WorldNet Daily has played a pivotal role in giving a lot of publicity to hate crimes, abuses, and persecutions of Christians, and such workplace bias, discrimination bills, and things like that. So the evangelical church is waking up to this danger. In fact, just recently, the head of the National Religious Broadcasters, which is really very definitive of evangelicalism in America, he announced that Christians must brace themselves now for increasing hate crimes prosecution.
Ted, we've got it. We've got to take a break now. We'll be back in three. Welcome back to Male Mentoring. We're honored tonight to have as our guest Reverend Ted Pike, a Christian leader who is worthy of that name. He actually does represent his people. As we continue, we're going to invite callers with questions. The number is 800-313-9443. Ted, I just want to explore why Christians haven't been more reactive on this issue. After all, 80% of Americans consider themselves Christians, yet this tiny Zionist minority seems to have enormous power. And what's wrong with the 80% of the American population? Do you have a theory about why they're so complacent? Is it, did Jesus say turn the other cheek or don't involve yourself in politics? Is it something to do with the doctrine?
Well, I think, Henry, that there's several factors. Of course, the church is reeling from massive materialism, as people are caught up in the good life and they want a religious doctrine which is easy and non-sacrificing, non-controversial, and so on. Certainly, since the Billy Graham revivals in the early 1950s, the watchword of evangelicalism has been that we must be positive, we must be respectable, and so on. And, of course, the message of Jesus Christ was often the opposite of that. Jesus went after the Pharisees, he denounced them, he was willing to speak the whole truth, regardless of what it cost him, and it certainly cost him his life under the persecution and arraignment under the Pharisees. But the church has also become a victim of several other factors. One of them is called Scofield dispensationalism. And this doctrine teaches that the same rule of conditional occupancy of the Holy Land and protection by God and blessings and covenant blessings upon the Jewish people, which were experienced in the Old Testament, where God said, you've got to obey me, you've got to exercise justice and righteousness and mercy and so on in order to occupy the Holy Land. Scofield dispensationalism says the opposite. It says that there's a different code of ethics now than existed back then, in which the Jews as a nation can come back into the Holy Land, into the Promised Land, without obedience, without exercising justice and mercy and righteousness, you see. They can come back with an unconditional right to come back into Palestine. And that, of course, flies in the face of numerous passages. There's more than the two dozen of them, even in Deuteronomy and Leviticus alone, which says very clearly that the Jews have to be righteous and obedient to God in order to occupy and dwell a holy land. So what's happened in the 20th century is that the evangelicals have joined with the Zionists in an unholy alliance, allowing them to come back en masse as a nation, come back and drive the Palestinians out and claim that they own the land with God's blessing. This is moral and biblical anarchy, completely flying in the face of everything God says in the Old Testament. Now, another thing that has a tendency to corrupt in Christians is the doctrine of the rapture. I'm sure you've heard of the doctrine of the rapture, which is taught by people like Tim LaHaye and Hal Lindsey and so on. And basically what the rapture says is that before a world government is formed, before the end comes, before the Antichrist is revealed, this one world dictator, the Lord himself will come down in a so-called first second coming of Christ. He comes two times, but he comes down, and with the voice of the archangel, all the Christians are lifted off the earth and go take an elevator ride to heaven, and they're taken away out of a world of political chaos and confusion and so on, largely which they've helped create. And so this is an escape hatch. It's a great snatch, as they call it, as the Christians are taken out, and the Christians don't have to endure any of the consequences of the mess which they, through their political naivety and apathy and inaction, have been allowed to create. In fact, polls have been taken of evangelicals today, and the vast majority of them believe this rapture is going to happen literally within the next few years. What they teach is that the generation that was born simultaneous with the founding of Israel in 1948 will not pass away from the earth due to natural causes. They'll all be snatched up into heaven. Now, the Bible does teach at the second coming of Jesus Christ, the second final and only second coming, there is a rapture or a first resurrection of the dead simultaneous with the coming of Christ. But it doesn't teach that Christ comes twice, separated by a period of 7 years, first to snatch out the church and then to finally come and rule on the earth. So this idea that the rapture is coming very quickly, very soon, certainly within the next few years, has a tendency to cause tremendous apathy among Christians. They feel like, who worries about straightening out the government and the judicial and legislative process when we're all going to be out of here in a few years anyway?
Ted, so you're telling me basically that Christians have been bamboozled by Schofield and by dispensation and rapture, and we know who's behind that, the Zionists.
Absolutely.
We'll be back in 3 minutes and with a long 17-minute segment with Reverend Ted Pike. We're back with Reverend Ted Pike, and we're talking about, Christians being active in politics to defend their faith. Ted, would you say that those liberal denominations have been infiltrated or just bought? Have you seen any evidence of infiltration or subversion?
Well, I think that the liberal denominations were very early infected with socialist, even Marxist left-wing ideas, and they produced basically a century of liberalism. But just as dangerous is the fact that the evangelicals have been allowed to keep largely their fundamentalist theology and doctrine, but they've been infected with Zionist, very great Zionist errors. And chief among those, of course, is the idea that God has an unconditional covenant with the Jews that they can occupy Palestine regardless of the moral condition in which they're in. And the evangelicals have bought into that totally, in total agreement with the Zionists, and really have played a definitive role in making it possible for Israel to ascend to the superpower status that it has today.
What would you agree or disagree with the statement that the ultimate goal of the B'nai B'rith is, and of the controlling power in Zionism, is the elimination of Christianity altogether?
Absolutely. I think that we saw with the Jewish role in the creation of Bolshevism that these evil Jewish activists and leaders had basically two goals in mind they had to eliminate two great barriers that were standing in their way toward world dominion. Number one, they had to eliminate capitalism and the free enterprise, laissez-faire capitalist system, which caused the forces of the Gentiles to remain strong and vigorous and independent and so on. And so Jewish philosophers and theoreticians like Moses Hess, Marx, etc., created communism, which basically had a leveling effect upon the powers of Christian civilization, capitalistic civilization, to be strong and vigorous. A very direct leveling effect as the proletariat were granted the estates and the wealth and the control of the bourgeoisie. And
Ted, let me interrupt you here. Sounds to me that this agenda is full of hate against Christians. Why?
Absolutely. In fact, the ABL lectures us about bias, against bias and discrimination and hate, and yet the Babylonian Talmud is basically the seedbed, the source, the ideological literature out of which this world conspiracy comes. Also, the Jewish Kabbalah or the Zohar is full of revolutionary ideas which state that the Jewish people are eternal. The Jewish people are here as intermediaries between the divine cosmology and the earthly and the the Gentiles are beasts meant to be destroyed or made use of. Certainly they are demonic and needed to be ruled over and subdued and so on. The Kabbalah is full of that.
Tim, let me interrupt you. Why haven't Christian organizations taken the Talmud to the tribunals of human rights and exposed it as hate? Why hasn't the Talmud been brought before a court of law?
Well, because any Christian researcher or scholar knows that if he delves into the Talmud and tells the world or tells his peers what the Talmud really teaches, it is immediately branded as anti-Semitism by the establishment, the religious and the Jewish establishment, and his career is over. So there will never be any kind of impetus to bring any kind of a decision or a referendum on that subject to scholarly tribunals, you see. And it's true that some seminaries, for example, we have a seminary here in Portland, Oregon, which did have a copy of the Babylonian Talmud, but no one reads it, and if they do read it, they are reading it in consultation with the local rabbis, making it very, very clear that there's not going to be any exposure, any dirty laundry brought up out of the Talmud, and so on.
The criticism of this Zionist agenda that they call anti-Semitism, this Zionist agenda is very evil. It's costing the whole world, especially America, a great deal. If they're branding opposition to it as anti-Semitism, surely anti-Semite would be a badge that people should be proud to wear.
Well, I have been called that by the ADL and even by fellow evangelicals, but the fact is that it contains tremendous stigma because images of Hitler and concentration camps and so on come to the surface. And as you may have mentioned at the beginning of the program, there is a Department of Global Anti-Semitism now established in the U.S. State Department. And in their recent report to Congress, the U.S. State Department says definitively that the New Testament teaching, the oft-repeated New Testament teaching, that the Jewish people and their leaders had Christ crucified 2,000 years ago is now what the State Department calls classical anti-Semitism. And Hitler is referred to as a classical anti-Semite. The pogroms against the Jews in Russia is classical anti-Semitism. So you see, there's all kinds of emotional baggage around the term anti-Semitism, and this is the result of the Jewish activism and the media hyping this as something that Christians should get as far away from as they possibly can.
Right, but do you believe that all Jews are conscious of this Zionist agenda and are part of it?
Oh, absolutely not. The main eye of this octopus, this conspiratorial octopus, is ADL and B'nai B'rith International. Now, B'nai B'rith International is a huge Jewish educational and religious organization. It's a fraternal organization. It has about 1,100 lodges worldwide, and it has presences in about 54 nations of the world. And this presence of ADL B'nai B'rith throughout Europe and Canada, U.S., Australia, and so on, this relatively small number of Jews comprising ADL B'nai B'rith, I think it's around 200,000 or 300,000 or so, are basically responsible as activists to promote the hate crimes agenda in the legislatures and the councils of their respective countries. Now,
Ted, who's behind the B'nai B'rith? Ted, who's behind them? Surely they're not self-acting. They're instruments.
B'nai B'rith is the umbrella organization for international Jewish activism. It's as active in Israel as it is in America. It's all over the world. And the forces behind B'nai B'rith basically is Pharisaic Talmudic Judaism. For example, Abraham Foxman, who is the head of ADL, is a convinced Orthodox Jew. He's a pious Orthodox Talmud-believing Jew who confidently expects is waiting for the appearance of the Jewish Messiah, which I believe, of course, will be the Antichrist. But he's a pious Jew. He's not a secular Jew. He promotes homosexuality. He promotes pornography. He promotes hate laws and all the liberal agenda, including abortion and all of this kind of thing. And yet he's a pious Orthodox Jew. You just have to say that there are a number of Jewish organizations, World Zionist Congresses, and so on. They're all part of this. A myriad of Jewish organizations, large and small, but they all go back to the central authority, which is the rambling, the huge Babylonian Talmud, which is the codified ethics and teachings of the ancient Pharisees who killed Christ.
Wow. Have you ever encountered the Frankist movement, the Sabbateans?
Sure.
Now, they were a civil war within Judaism. They were actually persecuted by the Orthodox and they persecuted the Orthodox Jews.
Yes. The Sabbateans were followers of Shabbatai Zevi, who was a poulterer in Smyrna, who around 1666 declared himself to be the Messiah of the Jews. And Smyrna is down in Turkey, and he claimed that through numerology and cabalistic occult means, the rabbis determined that he was the Messiah that the Jews had been waiting 1,600 years to receive. And there was quite a large following of Jewry worldwide, at least in Europe.
Let me interrupt. Surely the most germane point about the Sabbateans and the Frankists is that they were Satanists.
Well,
and
what happened was the
rock Sultan belonged to them, and so did the whole Jewish banking community.
Yeah.
And what I don't understand is how come they were opposed to the Orthodox Jews and sacrificed a lot of Orthodox Jews in the Holocaust, which is means sacrifice, and which they financed by financing the Nazi Party.
Well, as I understand it, here's what happened. The Shabbatai Zevi became such a threat in the empire, the Muslim empire, the Sultan in Turkey, that the Sultan got a hold of him and, I understand, threatened to shoot him full of arrows unless he recanted. And if he was really the Messiah, then the arrows wouldn't have any effect on him. So he recanted. And what happened there when Shabbatai Zevi recanted was he showed to all his followers that he could tell a lie. He could use deceitful methods in order to survive, and his cause could go forward. And all of his viewers departed from the ostensible ethics of rabbinic Judaism, and they said, well, we can do anything we want to just as long as we win. In other words, the end justifies the means. And so the followers of Shabbatai Zevi invented a new brand of Judaism, the Shabbatean group, which was ruthless in its new ethics that you could do anything you could as long as you survived, including sacrificing your own people, betraying and sacrificing your own people if necessary. And this Shabbatean vein has continued literally to the present century, even into the government of the State of Israel, as Shabbatean Khazar Jews are absolutely without any kind of conscience, even in sacrificing their own people, as they did in the agreements with Hitler.
So do you make a distinction between the Sabbateans that seem to control liberal and reform Judaism and the Orthodox people do you make a distinction between these two strains, or ultimately do they amount to the same thing?
I think ultimately they amount to the same thing. The same distinctions could be made between the Khazar Jews and basically the Sephardic or the more authentic genetic Jews. They're all followers of the Talmud.
Let me interrupt you. We have a listener who'd like to ask you a question. Leo, are you there, Leo?
Yes, hi. Mr. Pike, while you're jumping on the topic of the Sabbateans, a rather interesting character, Barry Shamish, who is a Stone's catchist, which is a settler supporter, Zionist, talks about the Sabbateans. And he had to leave Israel fearing for his life because he knows too much about the NWO. And when a Stone Zionist has to leave Israel, you know something is weird. So I really think that the problem is that we're looking at Jewish Zionism and we're not looking at the Jesuits' role in the background. You see, have you both read the Extreme Oath of Induction?
I haven't read it.
You should read it really, really carefully, line by line by line. It's all over the Internet, the Jesuit Extreme Oath of Induction.
Uh-huh.
And they're the horrible spies that collaborate and create the problems. And they have their, all their secret signs to each other, even if they're in opposing sides, so they won't do each other in specifically. I mean, the whole thing is really, really sick, and it makes the Talmud seem like a bunch of chumps and pikers, comparatively speaking. I mean, the Talmud's no wonderful story tale either. But you read the Extreme Oath of Induction, and lots of things begin to get really, really clear, and you understand why the Jesuits were tossed out of 29 countries.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, what I believe in the broadest generalization is that the Jesuits and all branches of Masonry, which, of course, are very largely Gentile in their makeup, are the kind of the useful idiots, the tentacles of this great octopus. If we go into Masonry, Grand Orient Freemasonry, British Masonry, Scottish Rite Masonry, we find it, they're loaded with Kabbalistic Jewish symbols and so on. And what I believe is that in the simplest terms, there's a central eye to this octopus which comes out of the Talmud and the Kabbalah, which are the quintessence of Pharisaism, of that demonic synagogue of Satan who crucified Christ and are now looking for their ultimate Antichrist, who will give them a world physical government in place of the spiritual rulership of Jesus Christ in this world. And I believe that, of course, in the Reformation period, the Jesuits had to develop a very, very much of an underground means of communication and intrigue and so on, as they were battling the Protestants and so on. And I believe that, in fact, I think Weishaupt credits the Jesuits with some of the most advanced communications and secret layers upon layers of intrigue of any system, including the ancient Ismailis and the Islamic mysticism and intriguers and so on. But generally speaking, I believe that the main source of this conspiracy remains fundamentally a Judaic one, a Pharisaic rabbinic one, going right back to the crucifixion of Christ.
You see, I think that when we focus on the Judaic aspects of it, we're missing the other players. You see, Hitler was not made strictly by the Rothschilds. He was not made strictly by General Motors. He was not made strictly by the eugenicists. He was not made strictly by the Jesuits. All of them collaborated together. And these people have not broken their collaboration. The collaboration is still there. And I think we don't...
Neil, we have to interrupt for a message. Thanks very much for making that point, bringing in the other players.
Can I hold over?
We'll be back in 3 minutes and change the topic. Okay, we're back with Reverend Ted Pike, and we're talking about the threats that all Christians are under. And we only have 4 minutes left, Ted, so I want you to give me a short answer to this question, because I have another question. You know about the Federal Reserve. You know about central bankers. You know about how they've used that position to gain a monopoly in so many industries and basically economic control over much of the world. What would you say to the argument that this rabbinical Judaism is just an ideology, a kind of boilerplate, which is being used to really justify a totalitarian regime in order to protect the monopoly over credit?
Well, the the history of rabbinic Judaism is ancient. It began in Babylon in the two or three centuries before even Jesus Christ. It dominated Palestine, and it's a very real obsession of the Pharisees and their descendants to triumph over Christianity. Now, the Jews have demonstrated their merchandising and their financial abilities, their gifts as a race, and even the Khazars are gifted in that area, and money has
played.
I don't
know if you know this, but I'm Jewish, and I can tell you that I would say at least 50% of Jews want no part of what you're describing, if not 80%.
Yeah, I know it. But that's the point I was making earlier, that ADL B'nai B'rith, out of 16-17 million Jews in the world today, forms almost an infinitesimally small group of hardened liberal anti-Christian activists. And if you're aware of my my doctrine in eschatology, I believe that a minority, a remnant of Jews will be converted back to Christianity at the second coming of Christ. So my quarrel is not with the Jewish people. It's with these evil Jewish leaders who clear back at the time of the crucifixion to the present have manifested an underground and sinister anti-Christian tendency.
Right, and Ted, and that's why when they wave that anti-Semitism around, we can say, no, our argument is with the political agenda and with the leaders, not
Absolutely.
With the people. So
yeah, well, true classical anti-Semitism says that the Jewish people, by virtue of their heredity, their genes, and so on, are misfits of the evolutionary process. They're naturally degenerate, subversive, corruptive, and so on. That's traditional classical Hitlerian anti-Semitism. And that's why when people say I'm anti-Semitic, I don't know what they're talking about. See, all I'm doing is speaking like a Hebrew prophet to the Jewish people, saying that they have sinned, they have done wrong, they have violated God's commandments, you see. That's what John the Baptist, Christ, and Jeremiah, all of them did, and they were certainly not anti-Semites.
Now, they're trying, in your article, Bible's Hate Says U.S. Government, they're basically trying to outlaw any opposition to their political agenda. Is that right?
That's right. You see, the evangelicals are the biggest supporters of the Jews and the nation of Israel in the history of in the last 2,000 years. But what's revealed here is this new Department of Anti-Semitism, which is a creation of ADL B'nai B'rith, is colossally ungrateful for all the evangelicals have done. Now they're turning on the evangelicals, and they're saying that Christianity, New Testament Christianity, is inherently anti-Semitic. That's what Foxman says, that Christianity has created anti-Semitism, leading to the Holocaust in World War II. And so what they're trying to do is put a hate crimes noose around evangelicals. We're talking about 40 million evangelicals.
Right, and we've got to fight that. Jews and evangelicals together, we've got to fight that. And Ted, if I've heard of a Old Testament prophet or a New Testament prophet, you're it. I am very, very impressed with your message and with your eloquence, and I'm very grateful to you for coming on with such short notice. And I'm going to put this article, Bible as Hate Says U.S. Government, up on my website right now, henrymackle.com.
Thank you so much, Henry, for being
with us on such short notice.
Bye now.
Well, thanks again. And thank you, everybody. And we'll be back next week with Male Mentoring.